This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Last year, Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri. That shooting spawned a protest movement against police violence. In 2016, at least 194 blacks have been shot so far, the most recently a mentally ill 66-year-old black woman in New York City. There's been a lot of news coverage of the killings in Ferguson and New York City and Charlotte and elsewhere. And while a lot of the coverage has focused on the violence itself, the large media outlets seem reluctant to place these shootings in the larger context of systemic racial injustice and repression. Paul Street is the author of They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy, and he joins us to discuss police violence in the United States. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Now, the election of a black president in the United States was supposed to signal a kind of turn in race relations or even a post-racial United States. That clearly has not happened. Why not?
Well, there's a fairly superficial understanding in the reigning American media politics culture of what racism is. And, there's a sort of over-focus on questions of what color the people are in particular high positions. So you can watch the 6 o'clock and the 10 o'clock news in the U.S., and there's really fairly diverse now, racially, fairly diverse news teams. You have a black president. There are a lot of black, highly visible images of black success all over the media, and that tends to reinforce white America's tendency to congratulate itself on all the progress it's made. Meanwhile, underneath all of that, in everyday life, the basic institutions, how the labor market works, how the real estate market works, certainly how the criminal justice system works, which is probably the most transparently racist institution in U.S. life. All these institutions pretty much continue in the same long-term historical pattern of functioning in very disparate and racially segregated and unequal kinds of ways, in ways that really go back not just decades, but centuries, with changes, of course. And that really has not fundamentally been transformed to any great degree. And much of the white population, which itself is on the defensive economically, socioeconomically, has lost jobs, has watched its net worth decline dramatically, has experienced this incredible new Gilded Age upward distribution of wealth, to the point that, as Bernie Sanders was saying, the top tenth of the top 1% now owns as much wealth as the bottom 90%. Much of that population is not particularly in the mood. Much of that white population in that increasingly precarious working class population is not particularly in the mood to look honestly at what's happening racially in this country. It's a sort of unfortunate set of circumstances.
Well, I want to turn a little bit to the economic situation for black folks in the United States. Economically, what is a place like Ferguson, Missouri, or West Baltimore like for black residents?
Oh, there are communities. I think of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for example, where there was actually a riot for 3 days after another one of these smartphone-captured police murders. You know, where 40% of the children are living at less of the black children in the black community in Milwaukee. Similar numbers in St. Louis area, which is where Ferguson is. Similar numbers in Baltimore. I mean, name your major U.S. metropolitan area. You know, and in Milwaukee, for example, 40% of the kids are growing up in well below the federal government's notoriously inadequate poverty level, and all many of them disproportionately concentrated on the incredibly hyper-segregated north side of Milwaukee, or the north side of St. Louis, or the west and the south sides of Chicago, or the over-the-Rhine neighborhood in Cincinnati, or Bedford-Stuyvesant and Harlem in New York City. You can just go on. And the black unemployment rate continues to be double that of the white unemployment rate. The black poverty rate continues to be more than double of the white poverty rate. You know, and you can just go through the list. There's been a historic reduction of black average net worth of wealth under Obama, ironically enough. It started under Bush, and the Great Recession fell with particular weight on black America. And I believe it's right now median net worth, it's about six or seven black cents on the white dollar. I mean, you really want to see inequality. You know, income is one thing, but you really want to understand class and race inequality. It's about wealth.
It's incredible, because the dynamic that you're talking about is this incredible inequality between the, you know, the top 1% or the top 1/10 of 1% and the rest of the population. So there are some white folks who've been driven into poverty and are really facing things. Yet there's this incredible differential between white folks and black folks who are at the bottom of the bottom.
At the same time, right. You know, and a lot of that white working class decline is at least part of the story behind the support for Donald Trump down here, who thankfully looks like he's cooked, he's done. But there's a lot of angst out there economically in the hinterland and in the former blue-collar, former industrial communities, you know, the Rust Belt. That's why Ohio might go Trump. That's why part of, you know, the farm economy, too. Here in Iowa, where I'm speaking to you, Trump is sort of still slightly ahead. I don't personally think, in a political sense, that it is that it works to try and guilt trip the white working class, the white lower class, or the embattled white lower middle class. I think more it's a matter of trying to connect with folks, with white folks who are struggling, on how racism, and Trump really does represent a kind of scary kind of white nationalism and nativism. You know, how that doesn't serve their interests, and to try and recapture for them and with them some of the history of how, when working class people have made progress in this country, it's been through alliance with and solidarity across racial and ethnic lines. One of the great stories of the 30s and the 40s was the rise of the industrial unions with the slogan, black and white, unite and fight. And we have to appeal, I think, to their self-interest. Guilt tripping is not going to work much on folks who really don't feel particularly privileged, you know, when they're working for $10 an hour, if they're lucky, at Walmart, you know, and are being lucky if they can get full-time employment.
Paul, earlier you were talking about the concentration of blacks in poor economic areas and where you can just find this kind of racial segregation within cities all over the United States. Given the concentration of blacks in poor economic areas, what's the role of police there now?
Well, you know, it's been nice to see the media focus on how they're policing. I mean, more than I've ever seen in my lifetime. So it's very much like the 1960s. What's instigating protests and upheavals is pretty much always a shooting by police or some other form of violence by police, a choking, a shooting, a rough ride, which is how they killed Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Actually, those incidents are not really on the rise. They're just being captured on cell phones and getting into social media, and then making their way into the mass media on a scale like we've never seen. I don't think it just started with Mike Brown. I think the Trayvon Martin killing, which I believe was in 2012, sort of got some of the momentum going on that. But they're not talking about what, there's some focus on how they police, but they're not talking much about how they police. And you see a lot of this, excuse me, on what they're policing and what they're policing, among other things, is the continuation of de facto apartheid in this country. A lot of your worst policing takes place on sort of borders of gentrification, where more upscale whites are trying to move in, and they're trying to move blacks out into suburbanized ghettos and or back further into these highly super segregated concentrations. I mean, Milwaukee has what researchers call a segregation index of 81%. That's the highest in the country, but it's not that far off from Chicago or Cincinnati or St. Louis. And all that number means is that 81% of blacks in Milwaukee would have to move to another neighborhood or census tract if they were going to live in a neighborhood or census tract that had a racial composition the same as the overall metropolitan area. You know, all you really have to do is drive to one of these cities and go to those neighborhoods, and you'd just be amazed at the concentration of black populations in relatively compact and highly concentrated parts of the city. And, you know, housing markets and where people live, housing markets don't just distribute dwellings. They distribute everything that goes with where you live, quality of school, whether there's any jobs, are there full-service grocery stores, are there public services, is there green space, all these things that go with where you live. And when you go to these communities, the opportunity level is incredibly low, incredibly nil. There's no services, and there's no jobs, and transportation is problematic, and crime, and all that kind of stuff. If white poor folks were as concentrated in these neighborhoods as black folks are, you would see epidemics of white-on-white crime and violence and so forth.
We haven't even touched on the prison system, which I guess is like, you know, the other side, or kind of the when people are in these conditions and there's this kind of policing. We just see a massive population, black population, in the prisons. I wish we had time to touch on that today. We don't, but I want to acknowledge it. And I also want to ask you what you think can be done to start to turn around this situation.
Yeah. Well, massive parts of Chicago's black population, for example, rotates regularly back and forth between the city's poorest zip codes and what are called downstate prisons all across southern central Illinois. In New York, it's upstate prisons, and in Michigan, it's upstate prisons, from New York City to the upper New York State, or from Detroit to blah, blah, blah. You know, and right now, one in three black males in this country has a felony record. It's simply extraordinary. We have 2.5 million to 3 million people behind bars. More than 40% of those people are black. I mean, which is just globally unmatched. There's no country that comes remotely close to that. Not Russia, not China, not South Africa. And, you know, the first thing that needs to be done is a stand down from this constant stop and frisk surveillance and arrest that is just incredibly targeted around the war on drugs on black America, even though whites use illegal drugs, buy and sell illegal drugs every bit as much as people of color do, perhaps even more. And you know, this just sort of has to stop. This broken windows police. How they police matters, but it's not just how they police. It's the distribution of resources, of so-called public sector resources. If they just took a third of what is spent on militarized policing and constant surveillance and stop and frisk and so-called broken windows policing, which is just a kind of nice sounding phrase for saturating ghetto neighborhoods with cops, and instead invested them in public jobs programs and free child care and improved schooling and community gardens and infrastructural development in the nation's most neglected neighborhoods, make a huge difference. That's something else you don't hear about in the media. Why does so much of its taxpayer dollars go to arrest and surveillance and incarceration instead of to meeting social needs? These are things that Dr. King spoke about at no small length in the middle and late 1960s.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Paul. And it's definitely a very important, big, deep issue that we need to keep our eyes on and pay more attention to.
You bet.
Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Paul Street. He's the author of They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy. His article, The Roots Are in the System, Charlotte and Beyond, can be found at counterpunch.org.